From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. We're going to be spending the hour today with Professor Jennifer Doudna. She's one of the world's most brilliant molecular biologists, and she joins us from her home campus of the University of California, Berkeley, today. Professor Doudna, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
So, first of all, I'm wondering if we could start with a story. I read that around Thanksgiving of 2018, you received an email from a scientist in China, and that email had a very terse subject line, which was just two words. It was, babies born. What was that email? What was your reaction to it?
Right. Well, that was a pretty surprising email to get, as you can probably imagine. It was an email that it was quite short, and it basically explained that Dr. He Zhengkui had created CRISPR-edited babies in China, and that meant making changes to the DNA of these children that would become part of their genome and be inheritable by future generations, something that had not, to anyone's knowledge, been done before that. And certainly was a shocking thing to find out about at the moment when we were just getting ready to launch a meeting in Hong Kong about human genome editing, where the very topic was going to be the use of genome editing in humans, including in embryos or babies.
Yeah. So okay, and in that conference, he gave a presentation, right, about those CRISPR-edited embryos. And you've said in interviews past that you felt the hairs on the back of your neck standing up.
It was pretty wild. This scientist was on the schedule for this meeting, although none of us knew he was going to be presenting the kind of data that he showed. And it was really quite shocking would be one, astounding would be another, to see the actual data presented for making targeted changes to a gene in human embryos that was done for the stated purpose of protecting those embryos and the children that they grew into from future infection by the HIV virus. The problem was that, well, there were many problems, but, both the scientifically and technically, as well as ethically and societally, sort of everything was wrong with what he presented.
Everything was wrong. Okay, so folks, here's why this matters, because for those of you who don't know who Professor Doudna is, she is one of the inventors of the CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology. She published one of the first papers about it back in 2012. And CRISPR has been called one of the most important scientific discoveries in the past 100 years, at the very least. I mean, people are saying that it could transform everything about basic scientific research, about drug development, about agriculture, synthetic biology. Professor Doudna, is it hyperbole to say that people are talking about CRISPR technology as if it could really sort of change the world?
Well, it's the kind of thing that, it's sort of something that before you see the science behind it, it sounds like science fiction, because it really involves changing the code of life and being able to do that in a targeted fashion that allows scientists to make precise changes to individual genes or whole sets of genes that control the phenotype and, the whole look and behavior of organisms. And that's true across biology. So it's really a cross-cutting technology. And furthermore, it's widely available. It's not, it's not so technically difficult or expensive to do that it's only available to the few. And so it just really has transformed biological research, as well as we think the future applications of genome editing in the future based on its potential.
Yeah. I mean, so to put it mildly, you have helped usher into the world an elegant, low-cost way of editing the genes of anything that has DNA in it. I mean, it's the power to tinker with the very building blocks of life made more easy than it has ever been before.
And amazingly, it all started with bacteria.
Right.
That's what I love about it. It's a, you know, it has a very humble origin.
The little circular DNA of a little bacteria. I mean, tell us about that.
Well, you know, bacteria have been dealing with viruses for a very long time, and they've been around for a lot longer than humans and probably most other life on our planet. So they've been having to engage in battle with infectious agents for probably ever since their origin. So it's fascinating to find out how they do that. How do they fight back against viruses? That was the question that my lab and a handful of others had back when we started investigating these CRISPR immune systems. And it turns out that the way these systems work is that they are able to program proteins, one of which is called Cas9, to find and destroy viral DNA. And by understanding that fundamental process, it was possible to harness that as a technology for something very different, namely genome editing, because of the fundamental biochemical activities of these programmable proteins like Cas9.
So, listeners, I promise you, or warn you slash promise you, we're actually going to get in more into the science of CRISPR with Professor Dowden a little later in the show. But Professor, one of the reasons why we wanted to talk to you is that it's only been a couple of years. It's been a relatively small time in the lifetime of a transformative new discovery since that 2012 paper that you wrote, and yet that email about those CRISPR edited embryos with that subject line of babies born, you very soon after you and your team understood what the potential of CRISPR would be, started worrying that it could usher in a new era of science or use of this technology that had a dark side to it. Did you not?
Right. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that, you know, as soon as it was clear that this technology was working widely in different types of biological systems, different kinds of cells, it was really obvious that, you know, that there would be temptations to tinker with DNA in ways that could be really profound, namely altering the code of life in human embryos that would give rise to heritable changes. So there were a handful of us in those early days that were starting to think about how we would possibly be able to, first of all, communicate about that and do so in a clear way to people that were not scientific experts in the field, and also to raise awareness and figure out how we would move ahead with some kind of global regulation or some kind of restriction on using it in ways that could be very dangerous to humans and certainly have real ethical and societal issues as well.
So lay it out for me as simply as you can. You're one of the people who helped invent this technology. What's at stake? What's at stake for all of us if we don't have some sort of common global agreement over the best uses of CRISPR?
Well, I think what's at stake in the short term, at least in my view, is that we have to ensure that the public perception of this technology is realistic, and that means not being too afraid of something that has the potential to do real good, but also being realistic about what the risks are. And that's, you know, it's always a tricky balance to get right. And, you know, I think that's where we are today in the field of gene editing and with CRISPR in particular is, you know, trying to strike that balance. I feel that ensuring, public perception of the technology that's accurate is important partly because, as you probably know, we're already seeing CRISPR moving into the clinic for treating disease. We're seeing some really exciting announcements coming out about that. And that, you know, that will really shape in many ways how the technology continues to unfold. And so it's very important that people understand how, you know, at least a little bit about how this works. These announcements that are coming out are absolutely not about editing babies, right? Mm-hmm. They're about, you know, making changes in the DNA of cells that could help fight cancer or other diseases in the future. And those affect only individuals. They're not making heritable changes. So, you know, these are some important, they're sort of details, but they're actually not, right? They're really important distinctions in the way the same technology is being used in very different ways.
But it wasn't that long ago that you said perhaps there needs to be a moratorium on a particular form of gene editing, that germline or heritable type gene editing. But since then, you've said that even a moratorium may not be enough.
Right. Well, back in 2015, we had a meeting out here in California with a handful of people, including two of the scientists who had been involved in the 1970s discussion around an earlier technology called molecular cloning that was also, you know, had the potential to be dangerous, and people didn't understand in those early days of molecular cloning how it might be deployed. And so there was a quite, you know, at least in the scientific community, quite famous meeting called the Asilomar meeting in 1975 that David Baltimore and Paul Berg, both of whom are Nobel laureates, very distinguished scientists who had been engaged in that discussion. We had both of them at this 2015 meeting, along with a number of other folks who were using CRISPR in different ways to discuss how we would think about moving ahead and, you know, trying to educate the public about CRISPR technology and how one might imagine regulating its use in humans in particular. And that led to a publication in the spring of 2015 that called for a moratorium, effectively. We didn't use that word, really was basically raising the alarm for scientists that were beginning to deploy the CRISPR technology, that we should really guard against any rush into human embryos for many reasons that were discussed in that piece. And then since then, you know, as you pointed out, the field has continued to advance very rapidly. There were multiple publications from different labs that began testing the CRISPR technology in human embryos, not for the purpose of creating a pregnancy, but to see how it would work in that setting. And those experiments started to show that, you know, that could be done. And so it really did raise the potential to move ahead in the clinic, which, you know, led me to say we can't just ask for a moratorium. We actually have to do more than that.
Well, Professor Jennifer Doudna, stand by for a second. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Jennifer Doudna. She is a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. More importantly, she's one of the inventors of the game-changing gene editing technology, CRISPR. It's been called one of the most important and transformative scientific developments of the past century. It's an elegant and much simpler way to edit DNA, for lack of a better term. And while Professor Doudna recognizes the great revolutionary potential in CRISPR, at the same time, she's calling for all of us, countries around the world, to think carefully and intelligently and cooperatively about perhaps some of the limits that we ought to be putting on this fundamental power to tinker with the building blocks of life. So we want to know what your question is for Professor Jennifer Doudna. Now, Professor Doudna, we will get back to this sort of big Pandora's box question in a couple of minutes, but I can't resist. I'd love to just step back a little bit and talk, if I could, with you for a few minutes about your journey in science, especially as a woman in science. So, like, how old were you when you knew that, like, you wanted to discover about how life works?
Yeah, great question. of course, I didn't really think about it that way. I always loved math and science when I was a young kid growing up, and I didn't really think about it as a career path at all. I just, you know, it was something I enjoyed doing, loved solving puzzles and things like that. I think it probably was when I was in 10th grade in high school, where I had a wonderful science teacher, Miss Wong, who showed us kids in a chemistry class that science was all about figuring things out. It wasn't about memorizing a bunch of facts. It was about asking questions that had maybe never been answered before and then designing experiments that could maybe give you that answer. And I love that. I love that sort of process of discovery. And I think that, for me, coupled with just my fascination with applying chemical understanding to biology, was enough to, you know, draw me into the field of biochemistry. Even back then, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be great if I could be a biochemist? I didn't quite know what that was, but it sounded really amazing.
Well, and I've read that, was there a specific lecture where was it this teacher of yours who was talking about how normal cells become cancerous?
Absolutely. So, okay. You know, I did not go to a fancy school. I was at a big public high school in a small town in Hawaii, Hilo High School. Go Vikings! And you know, we were very fortunate that the state of Hawaii that year had money to pay for a few scientists around the state, professional scientists, to come into our school and talk about their work. And one of the people that came was a biochemist. She was from the Cancer Center on Oahu in Honolulu, the big city, and she came over to our little town and our school and talked about her work as a biochemist trying to understand why cancer cells, become cancerous. And I just was captivated by her talk, and I thought, that's what I want to do with my life.
But what about it captivated you? I mean, it seemed like it was such a seminal moment. Why?
I thought it was incredible that you could dive into the details of a disease like cancer that clearly is very complicated and understand it at the level of molecules, the chemistry behind what's driving these cells to grow out of control, and then not only understand that, but then maybe be able to take a rational approach to treating a disease like that. And I thought, that's amazing to have that kind of understanding of biology.
Oh, cool. Now, it sounds like you've had a very curiosity-driven career since that moment.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And believe me, I tell students all the time, I had no idea where it was headed at all, and I didn't even think about it as a career. I just thought, I like doing science. Let's see how I can do more of that. And, I was fortunate that I had a number of mentors along the way who, really encouraged my curiosity. And I think importantly, I also tell students that, I'm actually a pretty stubborn person. And, when people tell me that I can't do things or that something will never work, if I think they're wrong, I just keep going. And, I've had multiple times in my career where that's happened as well. So I think you have to, it's great to have mentors that encourage you, but you also have to know when to trust your gut.
Yeah. Okay. So the trust your gut moment, is that what got you into the research that led to the path of the discovery of CRISPR?
Absolutely, yeah. That really came about because, a couple of things had happened. So, I started my career as an independent professor at Yale University, which was fantastic. That was in the middle of the 90s. And, then I never thought I would leave, but I had an amazing opportunity to move to the University of California, Berkeley, which I ended up taking that opportunity in the early 2000s. And once I made that move, I started to investigate different aspects of biological research and kind of opened up some of the avenues that we were pursuing in the laboratory, one of which was to start understanding how cells really control their genetic information using molecules called RNA. And we were looking at this question in different systems, including in viruses. And then a colleague here at Berkeley, Jillian Banfield, who is in a completely different field, and not even doing experimental science in a lab, but her laboratory is basically out in nature collecting microbes and looking at how they survive in their environment, she brought to my attention a system that at the time had been called CRISPR, but nobody knew what it was or how it worked. But there was some evidence that she and a couple of other labs had at the time, this was in the mid-2000s, that this might be some kind of RNA-guided immune system in bacteria. And I was just absolutely fascinated by this possibility. It didn't seem like likely to turn into some big area of science at the time, but it seemed very, very interesting from just a fundamental biology perspective.
Oh, I love that. I love that. There's like this like little possibility, and you're like, let's see what we can make of it. When did you have that eureka moment that CRISPR could be capable of, you know, the transformative kinds of technology that people are now talking about?
Well, it came in hints, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, we started working on it and work that we did at the end of the 2000s, I think it was around 2009 or 10 or so, showed us that there were parts of these CRISPR systems that were capable of interacting with viral molecules in very specific ways. So that already sort of hinted that this might be a way that you could not only understand a fundamental activity in bacteria, but that you could potentially also harness that as a tool. And so that was work that was done by a former student of mine, Rachel Horowitz, in the lab. And she and I actually started the first little company that I'd ever started, was called Caribou Biosciences, around that idea of harnessing those CRISPR proteins for something different than what they do naturally. But then it was really our collaboration with a scientist, Emmanuel Charpentier, which we started in 2011 to investigate the function of another protein called Cas9 that led to that kind of eureka moment of realizing that this protein and understanding its biochemical activity of using RNA to cut DNA, and that was an activity that could be controlled by scientists. It's controlled naturally by bacteria, but we understood how to do it in the laboratory. That was when we really realized that this pathway could be harnessed for a very different purpose than it is used apparently in nature, and namely for altering genomes by genome editing.
Right. So you published this really seminal paper in 2012. And in the years since then, there have been, what, tens of thousands of papers published around what could be done with CRISPR? Is that fair?
That's fair. Yeah, it's crazy.
Tens of thousands. Okay. But at what point did you start thinking or possibly even feeling uncomfortable with what could be done with CRISPR?
Again, it came in steps. You know, I think initially it was, of course, incredibly exciting for me and those of us in the field in those early days to see all of the opportunities with this technology and the kinds of things, experiments that it enabled, and of course, thinking about what it could do biomedically, clinically, or in agriculture. It was just, you know, incredibly exciting. But fairly quickly, it was also clear that power, that capability of the technology had wide-ranging potential, including making heritable changes, making changes that could be passed on to future generations. And this was done, you know, frankly, was done early on in animals, it was done in mice and in rats, et cetera. And so, you know, I started thinking about, you know, gee, that didn't seem like there was any reason technically why it couldn't be done in humans. But I think for me, it was really in 2014, that was sort of 2 years after that initial publication from our lab, that a group published work showing that you could make heritable changes in monkey embryos. And they used those embryos to create a pregnancy that led to animals that were born with these targeted changes. And that was really, for me, the moment where I said, I've got to get out in public about this.
I mean, if I may, it feels like an Oppenheimer moment, right? A Robert Oppenheimer moment when, after the first test of a nuclear weapon, he began to grapple with the implications of the technology. You gave a talk at Berkeley, I believe, earlier this year, where you said you had found yourself lying awake at night thinking about the potentials for the technology, and that the discomfort that you felt is in part because of these really big fundamental questions about how we use great scientific advancements, right? Like, who are we as human beings? Can we stop the technology from being used for a new era of eugenics? Will it expand social inequities? I mean, these are very major questions that come from you're asking yourself about your own discovery.
Right, and as you point out, you know, I and others are not, we're not the first to grapple with these questions. In fact, there's a long history of that. I think that when you look back at you know, human discoveries, technologies that have come along, very typically, if the technologies are wide ranging and offer a lot of capability, they also come hand in hand with, you know, risks. And I think that was really what we were facing in those days, was just realizing for the first time that this, you know, and you can try to imagine me, you know, a biochemist, you know, working on this system that we thought was really kind of a niche area of biology, and having it really transforming into this technology that was, you know, increasingly going global and was so enabling, but also brought along these really profound questions about where this technology was headed.
Is the, you know, more than a half century, the 70-year-long effort to contain and deal with nuclear proliferation, is that a good analogy for us to work from in terms of thinking about how to how to manage CRISPR as a technology?
Yes and no. I would say it certainly captures that feeling of, you know, tremendous capability coupled with just enormous potential risk. But on the flip side, I think where it doesn't capture and doesn't have parallels to CRISPR is the fact that, you know, nuclear technology remains relatively difficult to get a hold of. Not impossible, but, you know, you have to be an expert and you have to have money, and, you know, there's a number of barriers to getting access to it. Whereas with CRISPR, it's really widely available. It's not expensive, and for people that have at least a rudimentary knowledge of molecular biology, they can use it. And so that just changes, it sort of, you know, changes the whole way that we need to think about it.
That makes it even more urgent, if you ask me, right? Because, I mean, you've said before that the temptation to tinker with that human germline is not going to go away. And if the barriers to entry for using CRISPR are so low, I mean, international treaties seem to be only the beginning of what we need to do to be sure the technology is used for human good.
Agreed. Yeah, I think it's going to require, you know, regulation on multiple levels, and certainly a lot of work just with public transparency about what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know what, Professor Doudna, I could monopolize this conversation with you for the entire hour, but let me let some of our listeners in. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Florence, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate your program immensely. My question is, I am one of the veterans who have a TBI, traumatic brain injury. And could this technology be used to help with that in any way? Maybe injection of that protein you're talking about. I got no idea. But I drive a truck, and it's real bad to get somewhere and forget where you're at.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to walk up to strangers and ask, where am I at? They look at you, you know, kind of weird.
Well, Steve,
it's something this could do.
So to help to repair or heal you from your traumatic brain injury. Steve, thank you so much for your call. Professor Doudna, is this a potential use of CRISPR technology?
Hi, Steve, and thanks so much for your question. I think that you know, just quite frankly, I think one of the big challenges for CRISPR as a therapy is going to be delivery, and this is and also knowing which genes need to be altered, and that's something that scientists are grappling with right now. So I think the answer to your question is that unfortunately not anytime soon would this be something that could be actually used in patients or for this particular purpose. Nonetheless, there's tremendous interest in using it for brain disease, especially for neurodegenerative disease. That means, you know, diseases that cause a progressive breakdown of the brain function. So that's something that people are working on, but I don't want to imply that that's coming anytime real soon.
Well, the place where we might see sweeping and very quick changes is, as you've noted before, is in agriculture and in food.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's something that is coming quite fast.
And why?
Well, it's because the ability to make changes to plant DNA and to do so relatively quickly and accurately compared to any earlier capabilities in plants has given the plant breeders the ability to manipulate genes that affect things like crop production, the ability of plants to deal with drought or pests that are coming at us from, you know, faster and faster due to climate change. I think, you know, this is something that, you know, really comes along at an important time in agriculture, because it does provide the ability to make these changes in plants much faster and certainly much more accurately than has ever been possible.
Right. And but it also, I mean, it's such a perfect example of how it raises questions about the differences in tolerances, social tolerances for even genetic modification in plants from nation to nation. So we're gonna explore that when we come back in just a moment. We're talking this hour with Professor Jennifer Doudna. She is one of the inventors of the gene editing technology CRISPR, and she's calling on the global community to really think bravely and intelligently on how to both continue to use her technology for good, but also not open up a Pandora's box as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professor Jennifer Doudna. She's one of the inventors of the revolutionary gene editing technology called CRISPR. She's also a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. And she's here to talk about why she believes the global community ought to get together and think very bravely and deeply about exactly how we want her transformative technology to be used for human good and how to prevent it from being used for ill. So many comments coming in online, Professor Doudna. Someone calling themselves Gumby says, just because we can, should we? R. Smolker says, the code of life is part of our common heritage of life on Earth. It is not okay to rewrite the code without at least some serious and holistic evaluation. Whereas Policy Watcher says, yes, we need to be careful about engineering other organisms, but engineering ourselves? I don't see a problem. We're already the biggest threat to other species on the planet, and I don't see how CRISPR will make it any worse. Okay, so a variety of opinions there. I want to bring into the conversation now Alta Charo. She joins us from Palo Alto, California. She's a fellow at Stanford University Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences and a member of the World Health Organization's Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing. Alta Charo, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, how much of an appetite or a willingness is there in the global community to come up with a common set of rules for how CRISPR can and should be used?
I think there's a huge appetite for global governance, but not necessarily for everyone to have the same rules. This is a field where people can legitimately have very different opinions about the wisdom of doing this, or even whether it violates some more fundamental theological or cultural norm. What we need is a system by which we can have countries set policies by some legitimate method and then coordinate those policies so that patients and scientists know where they can go and where they can't, where you can get funding and where you can't. And in this way, we can actually see a variety of outcomes and watch the technology develop, not only for humans, but as Professor Doudna was saying, very importantly for agriculture.
Right. Well, so I wonder if we might use agriculture as an example of how challenging this might be, because I was reading in one of Professor Doudna's previous talks that she used the example of a CRISPR-edited mushroom, right, that I think a group just sort of knocked out one gene of the mushroom, and so it doesn't turn brown when you cut it open anymore. And if I have this right, in the United States, given current FDA regulation, that mushroom would not fall under the category of genetically modified food, so it's fine, could appear in stores maybe someday. But in the European Union, it would be definitely classified as a GMO and may not be even allowed in Europe at all. And this is just over a simple mushroom that has one gene knocked out of it. So is that a good example of how complex it would be to come to, you know, a bigger set of agreements over the genetic engineering or CRISPR-driven genetic changes in human beings?
Well, yes, let's take your example of the mushroom. And in the United States, the issue is not whether it's been genetically engineered,
okay,
which is a more precise term for that GMO, but it's the question of how one regulates it. And in the United States, we regulate products based upon their risk to humans or to the environment. And in this case, there's been some examination about the use of genetic engineering. And the conclusion is that in some settings, it really does not add any risk over traditional forms of engineering like developing hybrids, which farmers have been doing for thousands of years. The Europeans regulate not based on whether the product itself is dangerous, but they regulate by the process by which you get to the product. And so they worry about whether you've used CRISPR or an older form of genetic engineering or using the oldest, which is hybrids. And they regulate according to the process, regardless of the outcome in terms of danger. This is a big problem, and we have many, many trade negotiations precisely over things like this. Yes.
Yeah. And do I have this right that the WHO has announced a registry for future CRISPR-related research that may go on?
Yes. So we're talking with the World Health Organization only about human applications.
Okay.
And there was a fairly widespread agreement that ideally the first step in setting policy is to know what's going on. That is, good facts, good policy depends on good facts. And so there's already a variety of registries regarding clinical trials, that is, tests that are already being done on human beings for medical therapeutics, like a new drug. But one question is, can we gather those together in a single place and identify those clinical trials that are using this new technology and for which kinds of conditions? The second step is to then try to get behind that and look at the more the earlier research, so-called preclinical research, so that we can see where the field is going next. What are the next diseases we think they might be working on based on the laboratory science, looking at the targets that they're working on? This helps us anticipate what kind of governance you need. Mm. If you're developing something that might be used as a therapeutic, let's say for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, but has the potential to be used by healthy people who simply want to increase their muscle strength, that raises a regulatory issue about a kind of non-therapeutic use that needs to be anticipated and handled by the regulatory agency. So we would love to know what's going to happen next.
Okay, so Professor Doudna, let me turn back to you, though, because before the break, you were saying that the barrier to entry for researchers who want to use CRISPR gene editing technology is pretty low. And it seems as if not that many people, regarding that Chinese scientist who used CRISPR on those two embryos that ended up being live births of two baby girls, that not all that many people knew what he was doing. So to Professor Charo's point about we want to know what's going on, even that seems to be quite a challenge here.
It is a challenge, and that's why I think it's so important that organizations like the World Health Organization are stepping up to the plate. To me, you know, having transparency is, as Professor Charo just said, is really critical. We have to know what's going on. The challenge is, how do you know, where do you draw the line? Do you ask everybody who's doing any work in human systems to be a part of that registry, or do you reduce it? You just focus it around people that are trying to make changes in human embryos or germ cells. You know, I think that has to be addressed. But I think transparency is critical.
Mm. Well, let's quickly go to a caller. Let's go to Pablo, who's calling from Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Pablo, you're on the air.
Hello. My question is, how is access to the technology controlled, if at all, considering that less responsible global citizens like China are obviously less squeamish about using the technology in arguably dubious ways? Mm-hmm. And I have a backup question for that.
All right. So, Pablo, hang on here for a second. Professor Charo, do you have an answer for him?
Well, there's no perfect answer. Yeah. You can't control every potential rogue individual. However, we are already beginning to see countries step up in light of international opinion. The Chinese are already beginning to engage in an exercise to develop a more robust research oversight system. In Russia, there was a scientist announcing his interest in using the technology again to try to edit embryos. And he announced that he would submit himself to the authority of the Russian ministries. And the Russian Ministry of Health announced that it was going to kind of follow what the World Health Organization had said, which is, like Jennifer Doudna had mentioned, this technology is not even close to ready and not even close to being proven safe or effective. So don't do it yet. Hmm. So we're seeing that. The other thing is that there are other sources of governance besides federal or state governments.
Yeah.
Journal editors can say, we won't publish unless you're doing something that seems to fall within the international norms. Funders can say, we won't give you money unless you apply some limits to what you're going to do. Insurance companies can say, we're not going to give you liability insurance if you're doing something that has not yet been proven to be safe enough. So we need to be looking at a constellation of actors, all of whom can influence anyone who wants to use the technology and lead them toward a responsible use.
Pablo, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Susquehanna, Pennsylvania. You're on the air, Mike.
Hi. I just had a comment. I mean, everybody is talking about the government and regulations and putting wraps on something that is, quite honestly, just natural evolution of the human race. We've been getting smarter and smarter for 5,000 years. This is just the natural next step, don't you think?
Mike, that is one of the great philosophical questions of science. Are we acting within the bounds of what evolution would have created? Are we speeding it up? Is it unnatural? I love this question, Mike. Professor Doudna, what's your take on it?
I agree that, you know, technologies continue to unfold. Humans continue to learn more about themselves and their world. That's absolutely the case. And I think CRISPR at some level is kind of part of that evolutionary process, if you will. Nonetheless, I think we absolutely have to be responsible about the way it's utilized in the future because it does have such profound implications.
I mean, being responsible also within the great framework of where we fall into evolution makes perfect sense to me, right? Just because it might be found in nature doesn't mean we should just use it willy-nilly. So I love that answer. Professor Charo, I just have one more question for you before I have to let you go here. I mean, for people out there listening right now, I suppose they're wondering, like, what might happen in the next year, the next 2 years, the next 5 years that might give them a sense of confidence that the international community is headed in the right direction and finding some ways to be responsible, in Professor Doudna's words, about how CRISPR is used?
Well, there are two significant international activities going on right now that complement one another. One is a collection of national academies of science and medicine that are trying to develop a much more detailed list of those kinds of experiments that would have to be done before this technology could ever even conceivably be used, no pun intended, for editing embryos or sperm or egg in a way that would result in a child who has traits that could be passed on to the next generation. And the World Health Organization Committee is working on the governance questions of how you would set up a regulatory system to oversee that. The second thing that I think is worth at least noting in passing is that there's something in between editing embryos and editing people who've already been born, and that is editing a fetus while still in the womb. Mm. There are some diseases that might not easily be managed if you edit it after birth, but there may be something less than making heritable changes. You edit something at the fetal stage, and the child could possibly be born already with a correction for what could be a serious disease, but it doesn't transmit to the next generation. That simplifies the ethical and regulatory questions considerably, but we are just at the very beginning of that with people at the University of California, San Francisco, and other places working on it. And of course, it is going to throw us right back into the abortion debate, as anything right. with fetuses would do.
Well, Alta Charo, a member of the World Health Organization's Expert Advisory Committee on Developing Global Standards for Governance and Oversight of Human Genome Editing, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Dowd, now we've got about 4 minutes left here, and if you'll indulge me on something, I just want to change gears on you entirely.
Sure.
My dad, in his previous professional life, was actually a molecular biologist as well. And in the mid-70s, this is like one of my favorite stories about my father. He got a chance to meet Barbara McClintock, right, who in the early 80s won the Nobel Prize for her groundbreaking research on transposons, right, on jumping genes. It took the Nobel Committee 40 years to catch up to her research. But so he got a chance to meet her, and he was like, he's related the story to me 100 of times, saying like it was like meeting Elvis. He was so just excited to meet this groundbreaking, brilliant mind in science. And especially given that she was a woman in a time where being a woman in science was extremely difficult. There are people right now, I'm going to include myself, who look at you in the same way. I mean, you're changing our understanding of what's possible with genomic material. Does the weight of that sort of settle on you, that people are looking at you as like a world leader right now?
Well, I still I have a few thoughts about that.
No pressure.
I still think of myself as that young girl growing up on the Big Island of Hawaii, out in the middle of nowhere. I often felt like the world was passing me by out there, and just my fascination about science. So I definitely try to keep myself grounded there, and think about why I got into this field in the first place. Just my love of knowledge and understanding, and I love the fact that I have a job where I'm paid to ask questions and try to answer them in Nature, and do that with really smart other people and students. It's just great. But my other thought is that I, like your father, I once also ran into Barbara McClintock. I didn't exactly meet her, but it was at the very first scientific meeting that I attended at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, where she ran a laboratory for many years and did her breakthrough research. And I was walking down the road. I think it was the first day of that meeting. I was a second-year graduate student. I was, 22 years old or 23 or something, very young. And I ran into her. It was obviously her, and she was walking along towards me. And I was way too shy to say anything, but I felt like your dad. I thought, yeah, it's like meeting Elvis. It's, she's just so incredible. And I was amazed even to be on the same property with her, so it was incredible.
People talk about her paper on transposons like it's this thing that sort of fell from the sky. I'm going to guess that folks are going to be talking about your 2012 paper on CRISPR in much the same way in the coming, in a generation. I really do.
Well, it's an exciting time, isn't it? I think we all appreciate that we're living in this moment, sort of proverbial moment in science and in general, where humans have at their fingertips now technologies, including CRISPR, but along with the knowledge of our genomes, that it gives us just unprecedented ability to affect the way that we interact in the world with ourselves, with other organisms. It's really profound. It's very exciting. And of course, it does come with a very big responsibility.
I can't believe we're about to quote Spider-Man, but with great power comes great responsibility. So Professor Jennifer Doudna, one of the inventors of the gene editing technology CRISPR and a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, Berkeley, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.